Bonsoir à tous et merci beaucoup d'être là aujourd'hui. Donc, nous sommes vraiment très heureux et très honorés d'accueillir ce soir cette conférence qui est organisée par l'ORDIP, l'Association des universitaires pour le respect du droit international en Palestine, et qui vont eux-mêmes se présenter dans quelques instants. Donc, cette conférence du professeur Richard Falk intitulée « Envisioning Palestinian Future », donc « Envisager l'avenir palestinien ». Donc, je vais commencer par nous présenter, nous les responsables du séminaire Palestine de l'Institut d'études de l'islam et des sociétés du monde musulman, qui accueillons cette conférence. Donc, Marie-Angela Gasparotto qui est là, Baptiste Cellier ici, Hala Abouzaki et Philippe Bourmeau qui sont absents malheureusement, et puis moi-même, Véronique Bontemps. Donc, en fait, notre séminaire, depuis un peu plus d'une dizaine d'années, cherche à saisir à travers différentes thématiques plusieurs aspects de la vie des sociétés palestiniennes, que ce soit dans les territoires occupés, en Israël, ou dans différents pays d'accueil, en camps de réfugiés ou bien en diaspora. Et cette année, on va se pencher plus précisément sur la question du quotidien des Palestiniens et des formes de normalisation de la violence qu'ils subissent sur un temps long, violence qui vient à la fois de l'occupation israélienne, bien sûr, mais aussi des différentes formes prises par l'exil, d'où le titre donc, de notre séminaire de cette année, « Penser l'expérience palestinienne entre occupation, relégation et exil ». Donc, comme la conférence de ce soir est en anglais, nous allons maintenant passer à l'anglais et je vais donner la parole pour présenter notre intervenant et faire un petit peu parler du séminaire à mon collègue Baptiste.
Thank you very much. So, thank you very much for being here tonight. It's okay. We are very honored to welcome Professor Richard Falk to this conference and very thankful to the organizers of this event, the ORDIP, for allowing us to welcome you here. Most of you may know Professor Richard Falk. He will be introduced in a few minutes by Ivar Eklund from the ORDIP, but we will say a few words as an introduction before. In fact, Professor Richard Falk is an American professor of international law at Princeton University and an important human rights activist. In 2008, he was appointed as the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. While fulfilling his charge for the UN, he had to overcome a lot of challenges due to his positions. As you may expect, defending Palestinian rights and condemning Israeli policies toward Palestinians is a difficult task, and it exposed him to defamation and calumny. His steadfastness defending justice for the Palestinians all those years is exemplar. The Israeli policies toward the Palestinian population, but also toward part of the Israeli citizens, are dangerous because they undermine the belief in the lawfulness while questioning its enforceability. Not willing to comply to international law standards while arguing for security creates in the long run hopelessness and devaluation of human rights-based approaches, as it will be explained a bit more by Marie-Angela.
This undermining double standard policy towards human rights and the rule of law is not only a local problem. Indeed, it involves in the whole international community, and especially the United States and the European Union, both claiming loudly to be defenders of democracy and the human rights. While both are very active in founding NGOs and the Palestinian Authority, they seem to be unable to adopt concrete measures to incite Israel to fulfill its proclaimed commitment to human rights. This is why the work of Professor Falk is so important for us. Professor Falk also offers us an amazing chance to introduce the actual research questions of our seminar on Palestine. By presenting his insightful experience on the challenges of enforcing justice in Palestine Israel, he will help us as social researchers to shed light and better understand the condition in which Palestinians live their everyday experience in the long run.
So, Again, thank you very much for being here today with us. And I will now hand over to Mr. Ivar Ekland, the Vice Director of President of the ORDIP.
Tout d'abord, pour remercier Véronique Bontemps et les organisateurs du séminaire Palestine d'accueillir la conférence du professeur Falk, je remercie aussi la direction de l'École des hautes études en sciences sociales. C'est triste à dire, mais par les temps qui courent, accepter une conférence sur la Palestine nécessite un certain courage que, jusqu'à présent, peu de présidents d'université ont eu, ou disons que les présidents d'université, à ma connaissance, n'ont pas eu. Alors donc, je salue ici la direction de l'École des hautes études en sciences sociales. Je suis à l'heure actuelle le trésorier de l'ORDIP, Association des universitaires pour le respect du droit international en Palestine. Notre site, c'est ORDIP, A-U-R-D-I-P. Pourquoi des universitaires ? Parce que nous sommes allés en Palestine, nous avons travaillé dans des universités et nous avons vu ce qui se passait. Et les discours et les mots sont une chose, mais avoir vu ce qui se passe vous change véritablement. Et pourquoi le droit international ? Parce que nous avons la faiblesse ou de croire encore que l'éthique et le droit vont primer sur la force. Alors, il me revient de présenter le professeur Falk. Alors, le professeur Falk est un juriste. C'est un juriste éminent, spécialiste de droit international. Il a été professeur à Princeton de longues années, depuis 1965. Maintenant, il est professeur de recherche à l'Université de Santa Barbara. Il a une très longue liste de publications, de livres. Il y a eu des élèves, enfin, il a une carrière très remarquable dans le droit international. Et en raison de sa compétence, il a été nommé à plusieurs reprises, il a été chargé à plusieurs reprises par les Nations Unies de rapports sur les droits de l'homme. Notamment en 2001, avec John Dugard et, je ne sais pas si je prononce bien, et Kamal Hussein. Il a fait un rapport pour le Haut Commissariat des droits de l'homme aux Nations Unies sur la question de la violation des droits de l'homme dans les territoires arabes occupés, y compris la Palestine. Ça, c'était en 2001. En 2008, en 2014, il a succédé à John Dugard comme rapporteur spécial sur la situation des droits de l'homme dans les territoires palestiniens occupés depuis 1967. Et tous les ans, il a fait un rapport. Et non sans mal, hein, parce qu'il n'a pas pu aller sur le terrain. Quand il est arrivé avec une mission à deux reprises à Tel Aviv, il a été coffré, mis dans une cellule et renvoyé. Et le dernier rapport en date, c'est son rapport de 2014 pour le comité économique pour l'Asie du Sud-Ouest, je crois, qui s'appelle Israeli practices towards the Palestinian people and the question of apartheid, la question de l'apartheid. Alors, ce rapport est disponible en français. Vous le trouverez là-haut, si vous le voulez. Il est disponible en traduction française et il est extrêmement intéressant. Et il est, d'ailleurs, il ne l'a pas fait seul, il est co-autoré avec Virginia Tilley. Alors, le professeur Falk est aussi un homme engagé. Alors, je note qu'il est président, chair of the board, de la Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, la fondation pour la paix dans l'âge nucléaire, fondation qui milite pour l'interdiction des armes nucléaires. Il dirige également à Santa Barbara un projet sur Global Climate Change, Human Security and Democracy, le changement global, le changement climatique, la sécurité ou la sûreté humaine, donc la nourriture, des choses comme ça, et la démocratie. Donc, je veux dire, c'est un homme qui voit les problèmes globaux. Et malheureusement, la Palestine n'est qu'une fraction des problèmes globaux auxquels le monde s'affronte en ce moment. Ceci dit, pour le changement climatique, comme pour les armes nucléaires, et comme pour la Palestine, il y a ce que Gaulle appelait les « unwelcome truths », les vérités qui ne sont pas bonnes à entendre. Ne sont pas bonnes à dire. Alors, le professeur Falk, malheureusement, il y en a beaucoup. Le professeur Falk Et le professeur Faruk est un homme courageux, puisqu'il a le courage de donner, de dire ces vérités qui ne sont pas bonnes à dire. Et je lui passe donc la parole. Merci. Just to let you know, I said you were going to say some unwelcome truth.
Thank you all for these gracious introductory words. I'm very happy to have this opportunity to meet today in this academic setting. And I apologize for not being able to speak to you in French. I come from an underdeveloped country, and especially culturally. And so we've grown too accustomed to subjecting others to our poor American version of English. What I want to try to say focuses on this question of why we felt it important to shift the focus of concern for those who are seeking a sustainable peace between these two peoples from ending the occupation to what we call ending apartheid. And that is the central kind of policy or political implication of this controversial UN report that I was one of the co-authors of. But let me try to say a few things about the present reality that conditions this shift in emphasis, which I think is partly a sense of frustration and failure with efforts to resolve the conflict by less drastic language and less confrontational manner. And I think it's important to appreciate that from a Palestinian perspective, they have suffered a series of disillusionments ever since 100 years ago, the British Foreign Office decided that to lend support to the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine without ever consulting the people who lived there. And not only was it the British Foreign Office, but the whole theme of support for this project was reinforced by the League of Nations, which gave Britain authority to govern Palestine according to its own foreign policy criteria, which included this support for Jewish immigration and for building a Jewish homeland in Palestine. With the one of the, I think, aspects of this that makes it such a unusual development in international life is at the time of the Balfour Declaration, there were approximately 5% of the population was Jewish. So this kind of goal was being imposed on a large non-Jewish majority population. And it is in that way that this conflict has evolved by stages. And one of the features of this evolution has been the dynamic on the Zionist side of what I call double coding, that is, expressing public support for one set of goals, but actually having a undisclosed text for a much more ambitious set of goals. So at the first stage, Zionism settled for the idea of a homeland. And once that was established, they turned against the British, who had been their patron, to make Palestine ungovernable, because they didn't want just a homeland, they wanted a state. And so that was the dynamic that occurred during this period of the mandate. And in that period, the basic British response, which is their standard response to conflicts under their colonial dominion, was to recommend partition between the two peoples. And this was back in the 1930s under the auspices of the so-called Peel Commission. And this partition recommendation was then, over the objections of the Arab world and of mostly the non-Western world, was accepted by the UN General Assembly in 1947 and accepted by the Zionist movement. And again, as with the homeland stage, the partition stage was also only accepted in a public way. The actions of the Zionist movement were designed to do other things, not only Israeli statehood, but Palestinian dispossession from the territory where an Israeli state would be established. And the dispossession was combined with a unconditional denial of any right of return. And this was not primarily a racist initiative. It was an initiative designed to allow the Zionist movement to combine Israeli statehood with Israeli constitutional democracy. And combining those two things depended on getting rid of the majority non-Jewish population, which was at that time, even with all the immigration during the 1930s, it was still only about a third of the population of the area where Israel was established. So from the very beginning, there was this double-coded development. And in the 1948 war, the lines of armistice were set in such a way as to exceed significantly the territory given for the establishment of the Israeli state by the UN General Assembly. So instead of being 55% of historic Palestine, it became 78%. And it's been on that basis of 78% and 22% that the two-state consensus has been shaped over the years. And significantly, in a kind of unilateral initiative that Palestinians have never been given credit for, they actually accepted this allocation of territory back in 1988. The PLO and the Palestinian National Council both accepted the legitimacy of Israel as a state, provided they withdrew to the 67 boundaries. But again, the true Zionist objectives were not just the establishment of a democratic Israeli state. They also wanted to have a Jewish state, and they wanted to have their territory correspond to biblical Palestine or biblical Israel, Israel of the promise, so-called promised land, which was a religious and traditional concept that had no basis in either law or contemporary morality. But it was the underlying political priority of Zionism and of the Israeli leadership that made a political compromise impossible over this long period of years. And beyond that, and this is where it's important, I think, to understand why the ending the occupation isn't sufficient to move toward a genuine peace, is that in order to have a Jewish state in a context of a non-Jewish society and a non-Jewish majority, it's necessary to have a way of repressing those that are not being, whose identity is being marginalized and subjugated. And that's at the core of this conflict from the beginning has been the struggle between two peoples rather than a struggle only over territory. See, and ending the occupation creates the illusion that it's really about territory. But when you talk only about territory, you forget the several million refugees living in refugee camps for either 70 years or 50 years, an extraordinary ordeal. And any of you who have visited these refugee camps understand how difficult it is to live there for a week, much less for your entire life and for generations, your children, grandchildren, and so on. So the notion of peace has to embrace the refugees and the involuntary Palestinian exiles. And it also has to involve those non-Jews, the Palestinian minority in Israel, which is approximately 20%, that have been given citizenship, but at the undisclosed price of being subjugated by a series of discriminatory nationality laws that denies them rights of family unification, access to property, access to employment, participation in government, no right to deny the Jewish character of the Israeli state, and even no legal right to observe the Nakba or the dispossession of their own people. So the extent of this structure of domination needed to reach each of these domains of where the Palestinians have been subjugated in different ways. And Israel, to do this, has pursued a policy of fragmentation, of deliberately keeping the Palestinian people in these distinct categories. And remember, part of the Zionist ideology was to be democratic, and so it was always necessary to find ways to exclude from the polity, from the political community, enough Palestinians so as not to threaten the Jewish majority. And to do that required a harsh structure of domination and subjugation, and has produced this Palestinian experience of victimization. And so I think it was against this background that the UN Economic and Social Commission for West Africa, ESQA in UN jargon, the foreign ministers of the 18 Arab countries that make up ESQA asked the Secretariat to commission an academic study of the credibility of this allegation of apartheid. And a political scientist named Virginia Tilley, who's a world expert on apartheid in South Africa and its extension to Israel, collaborated in producing this study. And what makes the two things that I think make it responsive to what I was saying earlier were, first of all, that it does make an effort to analyze from a international law point of view the crime of apartheid as it's set forth in the International Convention on Apartheid. And that involves more than discrimination and domination. It involves the reliance on what is called inhuman acts in order to sustain this structure. And so our report tries to enumerate the Israeli policies and practices over this period of 70 years where the Palestinians have been victimized. And the implication of that is not to, as many critics say, the implication of that is not to challenge the existence of the Israeli state. It is to challenge the existence of a Jewish state. And it is really a recognition that given the competing realities of two peoples struggling over their own destinies, that the maximal Zionist goal is a Jewish homeland, and that the state in a international environment that has been shaped normatively and ethically by human rights understandings cannot adopt a identity that privileges one people over another people. And that the attempt to do that is always, in this 21st century, to be accompanied by very harsh forms of repression. And so repression is embedded in the idea of discouraging resistance or suppressing resistance. And from all of this assessment, the implication is, if you want peace, end apartheid. Not withdraw, not only withdraw from the occupied territory, but end apartheid. And the South African precedent is helpful and illuminating in this respect, because in South Africa, as in the Israel-Palestine context today, it looked impossible to imagine a peaceful transition from the apartheid regime to a constitutional democracy. But what occurred, and what is politically, I think, crucial to understand, is that it was the international pressure, the anti-apartheid movement, that led the South African elite, the leadership, the Afrikaner leadership, to recalculate their own interests in such a way as to decide that they would be better off in a constitutional democracy, multiracial constitutional democracy, than they would be maintaining the regime of apartheid, given the combination of African resistance and global solidarity and the equivalent of the BDS movement that was globally organized at that time and had the backing of the UN. So the implication for Israel is that until there is enough international pressure to lead the Israeli elite to recalculate their interests, there is no incentive to create a real peace. And there is, because of the geopolitical context, there's no real international pressure to do so. So the debate within the Israeli context at the present time is between those that say, we've won and the Palestinians have lost, it's a lost cause, the world should move on and let us improve this material situation of the Palestinian people, and essentially declare victory and the end of the conflict, not by diplomacy, but by unilateral fiat. And the other view is this will be to create too much of an international backlash and create an unfavorable political atmosphere for Israel. We're better off maintaining the status quo and living with this periodic unrest and occasional violent resistance. And interestingly, the two Likud leaders, the president favors the first kind of scenario, and Netanyahu, the prime minister, favors the second scenario. They're both Likud leaders. And the second kind of Israeli reaction to the present context is to say, we need to incorporate the West Bank, what's called the West Bank internationally, what they call internally Judea and Samaria. We need to incorporate those, but by doing that, we endanger the demographic majority. And so we have to move from our original commitment to a democratic society to a society that satisfies the biblical entitlement to the Holy Land, the Promised Land in some Jewish formulations. And so on the one side you have this analysis that suggests that peace can only be established by ending apartheid. And on the other side, you have this understanding that says we've reached the point where we can achieve the end goal. The end game of Zionism is within reach. See, and so it's a kind of critical juncture at this stage as to which of these, which path will prevail. One path is the path of permanent repression, no end in sight for the refugees and other Palestinian victims. The other is a radical departure from the path that has been pursued up to this point. Now, looking at this, the situation and trying to think toward the future, which of course is there are many complexities, there's several factors that favor the Israeli view. One is the developments in the Arab world since 2011, the change of leadership from the Muslim Brotherhood, Morsi leadership, to the Sisi leadership, the Saudi Arabian tacit collaboration with Israel, and the general kind of normalization of relations with Turkey, the overall regional balance of forces has turned very much in the Israeli favor. And you have that combined with the unconditional geopolitical support given to Israel by the United States, and the less unconditional support given by the European Union, but moving more or less in the, not really challenging the US approach to the issue. So from this perspective, from the Palestinian situation does look very bleak, and from a political realist point of view, it could be said to be a hopeless situation, a lost cause. What I think this forgets or overlooks is the degree to which the outcome of these political struggles for the internal political destiny of a country has not been shaped by the side with the predominant military power. I like to say the great unlearned lesson of the late 20th and 21st century is that military superiority has lost much of its historical agency. And if you look at the anti-colonial struggles, they were all won by the weaker side. Weaker side in terms of hard power. And for the United States in particular, the unlearned lesson should have been learned after the Vietnam War, where there was total domination of all the military theaters of combat, land, sea, and air, and yet the U.S. lost the war. See, and that's the, see, and beyond that, losing the war, there's an inability to learn. Because the investment in the military, what Eisenhower long ago called the military-industrial complex, is so enveloping of the government for so long now that it's impossible for in the mainstream to think outside the military box. So they keep reinventing how to win these kind of struggles with national resistance movements. And they keep losing. But that doesn't change the consciousness. And that's part of the need to create this better understanding that legitimacy wars are the way in which most, not all, but most conflicts are resolved in the 21st century. And the legitimacy war is won by the side that controls the high ground of public opinion, international legal analysis of the respective arguments, and a sense of international justice and morality. In other words, the legitimacy wars are wars that involve soft power as distinct from the traditional military combat that is a test of hard power. As I said, not every legitimacy war that's won leads to this favorable political result. Tibet, for instance, has won the legitimacy war, but it can't alter the situation. So it's not a sure thing. But the historical tide of the last 75 years is definitely on the side of national resistance movements that persist and eventually create the kind of pressure that can prevail. And for the Palestinians, they've had to deal with a series of disillusionments. They for first hoped that they would be liberated by their neighbors, the Arab neighbors. And then they relied on their own capabilities to wage armed struggle. And then they thought that favorable resolutions in the United Nations and the having international law on their side was sufficient to create a positive outcome. And then they put their faith in the Oslo diplomacy and the notion that a negotiated end to the conflict could produce a reasonable outcome. So all of these expectations turned out to be disillusioning. And the final disillusionment is with their own leadership, which has not been able to represent the Palestinian people as a whole, for one thing. It has marginalized the concerns of the refugees and exiles and the internal Palestinian minority in Israel. It's been collaborationist and very weak, or it's been Islamist and not responsive to the values of a large part of the Palestinian community. So there are all these disillusionments. The one bright side of the Palestinian story is the civil society side, their own resistance and international solidarity. And the peak moment both for Palestinian resistance as effective and as gaining international approval was the First Intifada in 1987, which was a creative, massive innovation in nonviolent resistance, and really did shake the foundations of the Israeli establishment for a certain period of time. But it was fairly ruthlessly oppressed. But I think what it did do was to create the understanding, the Palestinian understanding throughout the world, that the path to peace was a combination of nonviolent Palestinian resistance and global solidarity in the context of waging this legitimacy war, relying on international law arguments and on achieving statehood within the confines of the UN, which they did through the General Assembly resolution of 2012. And so let me make just a few concluding remarks. The importance of the apartheid analysis of our report is to treat the Palestinian people as a whole and to treat people as the core of the conflict, not territory. And secondly, it is to normalize the shift in discourse from occupation to apartheid. And this is happening both within the UN and within diplomatic circles. There is a sense that this is no longer a shocking kind of allegation. And indeed, if you look at the internal Israeli discourse, they have for years been talking to each other about the risks of becoming an apartheid society if they don't resolve the Palestinian issue. And that includes leaders like the founding president, founding prime minister David Ben-Gurion, who had that fear, and several of the prime ministers, including recent ones like Olmert and Barak. So there's nothing novel about saying that this kind of structure of domination is resembles apartheid. And it should be understood that apartheid is a freestanding crime. It doesn't have to resemble the regime in South Africa. It has to be a systematic structure of domination sustained by inhuman acts. And that's its distinguishing feature. The third point is that if there is to be peace in the sense of these two people living together in a peaceful manner, it has to be preceded by ending apartheid. You cannot go to peace by jumping over this structure. It is a roadblock that can't be circumvented. And the fundamental fallacy of the Oslo diplomacy was to treat it as something that could be negotiated or postponed to the indefinite future. And everything that's postponed to the indefinite future means it won't and can't happen. So the Oslo diplomacy was always based on false consciousness, in my view. So it seems to me that for those of us that are concerned with a just outcome of this struggle, it is essential to recognize that the only way to end apartheid at this stage is by increasing pressure on the Israeli leadership and society, and increasing that pressure by nonviolent but militant means, and the best instrument for doing this is the BDS campaign. There's no other credible alternative, and the constant recurring international motif of reviving the direct negotiations between the parties and the two-state solution, all of that just gives Israel additional time to consolidate their annexation of the West Bank. So if you're serious about pursuing peace and justice for these two peoples, not just for the Palestinians, it seems to me that the way to engage with this struggle is by supporting BDS and the other efforts to increase the pressure on Israel to move away from an apartheid strategy of domination. Thank you very much.